Welcome back to On Air with Matthew James. In today's episode, we're joined by Chris Van Almenstein, of course. We're chatting about her various careers and we're also getting to know her a little bit more. Remember, you can get in contact with us by getting at us on social media at Matthew Hallett on Instagram and at Matthew James SA on Twitter. Let's go straight into it. And here is my interview with Chris. Enjoy. So thank you so much for joining me today, Chris. How are you doing during this new version of our normal?
Nothing's changed. I've had vaccinations. I haven't had COVID. Life is the same and better. I think it's much better than it was ever before.
That's absolutely amazing. So let's start off straight off the bat. Could you walk us through your journey? Like, where did all of this start for you and how did you get into this industry? And also, was it something that you wanted to do all the time?
Okay, so now I'm going to tell you that I don't know which industry you're talking about because I've been trying to keep a track of how many careers I've had. And I think I'm on my seventh one now. So I would never, ever have thought that, you know, I was going to become a maths teacher. Can you believe it? That's how high my goals were because I had a very attractive maths teacher at school. I mean, that's how silly girls can get. And luckily, while I was studying at Stellenbosch, I switched to BCom. And that's when I think my first lucky break started happening. So I've been a futures researcher, which I did at the University of Stellenbosch. Then I got married and I had to follow a husband, ex-husband, I should say, off to Pretoria. And there was no futures research there at all. So I just switched to market research. And I did market research for quite a long time. I worked at UNISA and then at ad agencies in Joburg. That was my lucky escape from getting divorced to get to Joburg and leave horrible Pretoria behind. And I worked at J. Walter Thompson and Young and Rubicam there and did an MBA part-time summer on the side, which also was a good confidence booster. And it looked good, you know, on a CV in those days. And then I was also a lecturer at Fitz Business School for a while where I'd done the MBA. And then I ran after a man down to Cape Town, which was the best thing I've ever done. And he'd already disappeared into the woodworks by the time I got here. But I've been here for 30 years and I would never leave Cape Town. It's been so wonderful. And I realized that nobody knew me in Cape Town. That's how it is. You know, the ad industry is very insular, and I had to start marketing myself from scratch, which was a good thing in itself. So the first thing I did is to try and create awareness, and I had a friend who approached the Argus, still called the Argus, and I wanted to do an advertising and marketing column in the weekend Argus like they have in the Saturday Star. Nobody had done it here before. And they gave me that opportunity. It was called Ad Monitor. And it was just summarizing news about marketing and advertising down in the Cape. And through that, I'd been brave enough to start in Cape Town as a research consultant, market research consultant. And there wasn't even such a career in those days. You either worked for a market research company or you didn't. But anyway, it worked, which was great. And I could then afford to rent the first little business cottages that the waterfront had opened up before they started building big office blocks. There were five little Victorian cottages in the waterfront. And I rented one and sublet half of it to a TV company. And lo and behold, two doors away from me was Hunt Lascaris, a very well-known ad agency that was in Joburg and that had opened in Cape Town office, and they opened in one of these little cottages as well. So they contacted me and asked me if I couldn't do the PR, but I was a market research consultancy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm a writer. So I was a writer then already. Mm. So I thought, well, if I can do market research, I can do PR as well. And they came with a first client called Baker Street Snacks, which had the most fabulous products and brands called Jumpin' Jack popcorn.
Oh, yes, yes. We know Royce, that brand.
Yeah. Royce's chips. And and there was a pretzel brand as well. And we just loved eating these products and doing product drops. Everything was traditional media then. You know, it was many magazines, women's magazines. And the magazines loved us because they were fabulous fillers in what's new little columns, you know, in the magazines.
Yeah.
So I learned about PR. I learned about dealing with clients, you know, even more so. And the client we had was an ex-Simba client. And he was very well known in the industry. And people were taking notice of the amazing coverage we got. Yeah. I mean, my budget for the year was 20,000 rand. So you can just imagine. Yeah. Even though the client, one of the partners in the business had a helicopter. So we could organize helicopter flips, or we did parties at the factory where they were making the products and flew them from the center of town into Montague Gardens. So we were, you know, that name just quickly became known. And so our client was fantastic at referring us to other clients like Bonita, which is now Parmalat, Aylesbury Ice Cream, and a whole host, Longridge Wines, and other food-related things. So it's quite weird for me that I have been in food, but in a completely different
I was just gonna part say, of always, food. You've always been, it seems like you've always been busy with food brands, but on the other side of it.
Yes. So... anyway, but, you know, it was fantastic at its time. And then I started, I bought a little holiday cottage in Vermont, outside of Manus, at that time. And then I thought, well, why not start a guest house? Because bed and breakfast were just starting then. And so I sold that little Vermont cottage and I bought a house in Manus itself. And then I became a guest house owner, which was like not something I'd ever dreamt of.
I was just going to say, no experience. I'm just going to start a guest house.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But luckily, we were so few, you know, that we did very well because I just jumped into that trend very quickly. And I did so well in Amanas that the house that I was living in Camps Bay was just a three-bedroom house that I quickly had that built up to another story up, you know, upstairs and did three or four rooms upstairs and lived in the downstairs section. And once I had finished my five-year contract with the waterfront in terms of the offices, we moved into the house and used the downstairs section the lounge and dining room, you know, as offices for the PR company. But the we did so well with the guest housing that I sort of, and there was an economic crisis at that time that I then did less of the PR and we concentrated on the guest housing. And eventually I grew that portfolio to having a whale cottage in Camps Bay, in Amanas, in Franschhoek, in Plettenberg Bay, and even in Buckhoven in Camps Bay for a while. So that was 20 years of that. It was a long time and a big challenge to do that all by myself. And that I'll never in my life do again. So I've finished with that.
Lesson learned, been there, done that, got the T-shirt.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was crazy, you know, to try and run four guest houses that were so far apart. Where I wasn't, you know, there was trouble. So, but I often just only knew that afterwards. And I got this advice to, I saw Airbnb take over and I couldn't be an Airbnb because, you know, we didn't have catering facilities in the room. So it was taking business away in Camps Bay. Initially, we were a handful, you know, of guest houses and there was enough business to go around amongst all of us. But every Tom, Dick and Harry was then, you know, opening up an apartment or buying an apartment and then letting that out on Airbnb.
Yeah.
And the writing was on the wall. You know, the business was dropping, the revenue was dropping. I needed to get out of the business. And I felt I would be a total failure. I was the queen bee of guest housing. You know, I had to sell my guest houses. It was a terrible dilemma. And a fabulous friend called Nicolette Waterford, I went to speak to her, and she said, do it. She was in public relations herself, and she said her clients were also struggling, and she just thought it was the right thing to do. Yeah. And it took a year for 3 out of the 4 guest houses to be sold. The one in Amanus was a nightmare deluxe, which I won't bore you with, but except it took 5 years, you know, to get it sold to somebody else in the meantime, and to finally... on my walk every day.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's life. Except when lockdown started, I had to face my financial situation. And what I was doing was just spending money out of a money market account. And that was just dwindling. You know, and I was already making noises to my son, you know. I may need some help because I'm only 60-something, going on 21. And I may need to...
18.
You know, come and live with him in England, which is the worst thought possible, I think, for him and for me. And so I had to face where my expenses lay, and I started chiseling away at those. And it was very good feeling that one can be in control of your finances and not just look away from it. And I realized I needed income. So a headhunter or a recruitment company contacted me because they'd seen something on LinkedIn, but I didn't look for jobs. I'm a very bad LinkedIn person. And so there were 2 jobs advertised or going, and they asked if I was interested. They were German, based on my German language capability. So that was interesting, to go back into my German past. And I tried desperately to reply to them. The one who needed a technical knowledge of a reservation system for airlines, which I had no clue about, so I was not eligible for that. And the other one was with Amazon, who had the most complicated application system within their system, within their website.
Yeah.
And there was one section that I just couldn't get into. I tried every young person I knew to help me to get into the, into the, into this section that I had to answer. It was mandatory. And I couldn't find help from Amazon itself. You know, you're just supposed to do this yourself. So I had to just let go and say, you know, it's not meant for me. I'm too old, I'm too untech, you know, not knowledgeable enough with tech to have done this Amazon application, and I just left it at that. And then in November or October last year, I was invited to try Utopia, which I'd never eaten at and I barely knew the name of. And my whole life changed from there because the GM at the time said to me, just by the by, they were looking for a social media company. And I've never worked for anybody else, you know, in that regard. And I can do my own social media, and I have been doing, obviously. But I never thought that I could actually earn an income and help restaurants, you know, with that. And restaurants being my favorite area
of your many careers.
I then... asked very, I mean, quite not even, I'm not pushy, but with chutzpah, I asked if they would mind if I presented a proposal to them. And so my PR experience from 30 years ago came handily to the fore. And I wrote a proposal, and I couldn't believe that they chose me to do that. work for them. And I've absolutely loved putting Utopia on the map.
But also,
so much so that I nominated them on the KFM Best of the Cape Awards. And yeah, we made the top five finalists in the best date night category. Amazing. And we'll know on Friday, you know, whether we've won category.
Best of luck.
I've never done something like that before, but it was just wonderful to do that. So, as I said, that's my seven careers.
So let's talk about over seven different careers, right? At any point while you were doing any of them, did you ever think you'd become as successful as you were in those careers when you started out? Or was it just like, let me give it a shot and see where it goes?
Look, one doesn't gamble. You know, often, I think, especially initially, monetary survival. I was a single mom. I haven't mentioned my son, but, you know, so it was necessary. I took a gamble even buying a house in Camps Bay, which, of course, was dirt cheap at that time, and expanding, not knowing and not even planning, because one could never have foreseen the concept of an Airbnb, for example, you know, if you have a guest house, and how that can affect you, how it affected me in the end. But what I've learned is that every, I mean, even a disaster like COVID and lockdown has given us all new opportunities.
Yes, most definitely.
You know, so I never evaluated how good or not good will I be. I'm German enough that I just gave it my absolute best go. I worked like a dog, especially in the best times. But everything I did, you know, I did with passion and I did to the very best of my ability. So you don't think that you're going to fail, and I made sure that I wouldn't fail. So the closest I felt to failure was the guest, you know, giving up the guest houses. But wow, if I hadn't done that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to travel as much and live here in where I'm living in Camps Bay. And I realized, you know, that there's always another opportunity to do something, you know, for me to now start a career, you know, at my age. And some people sort of look at me and they think, wow, you know, I'm probably joking, but they're like thinking, what does she know about social media and about Instagram? Because when I used to dance, they did selfies, you know, so they wanted to tag me as well.
Yes.
And they said, are you on Instagram? Like expecting me to say, huh? You know, like, what's that?
And then you open it up and you see your whole full-blown Instagram.
Yeah, and they say, wow, you've got a 1,000 whatever followers. You know, like totally astounded, because their mothers and grandmothers were definitely not on Instagram. So that was hilarious, you know, having that type of reaction to it. But that was long before I did the work, you know, this was just being on it for myself privately.
Yeah. And that social media at that time was sort of more for the blog, which I think I want to just dive into as well. Is that with the Wales card, did you actually ended up converting that into a blog, which is where the restaurant, the love for restaurants came in and the views came in, correct?
Yes. I mean, I had in my guest house days, having had my own PR company, I realized that marketing was as important for my own business. It's much harder to do for yourself than it is to do for a client. But I knew that I had to stay in touch with, I had a database, email addresses of about 30,000. And I had received them. There were other industry people, hotel people, other guest house colleagues. And they were clients who booked with us. Or they were potential clients who had inquired but hadn't yet booked. So that made up the 30,000. And I had to continue speaking to them, because if they didn't book this year, then maybe they would book next year, you know, type of thing. So I did a newsletter, a very old-fashioned traditional newsletter that I sent out every 6 weeks or so. And it was all based on information that I got out of magazines and newspapers. Also, you know, the very old-fashioned way of doing things. And I had standard categories. It was restaurants, but it was only about restaurants opening or closing or chefs moving.
Mm.
I did things about wine. And if there was a whale story, because it was called Whale Tales, you know, that there was something. And then there was like an other category. I did something about tourism as well, always, every time. Cape Town Tourism, and then there was a provincial tourism body that kept changing its name and what it was trying to do. And I started being critical, you know, especially about the tourism bodies, because they were doing nothing for us in the, I mean, for me in the guest house industry, or say broader tourism industry. So anyway. And then blogging started 13 years ago, and somebody said to me, Chris, you must blog. And there was no more like once in 6 weeks newsletter. Then I gave myself the challenge of doing it every day. And
you still meet that challenge every day till today. I know.
But I don't write. I write posts Mondays to Fridays. I realize people look at social media at work. They're not doing it at weekends at home. And therefore, only since lockdown have I converted my Facebook post into a blog post every day. So that runs, you know, Mondays to Sundays. But and so it's been fun. It's been exciting. I've been in terrible trouble. I've been all sorts of dreadful things. But it's a good discipline to have, because in the mornings, despite having to write for my clients as well, I've learned to put myself first. I try and write blog posts over the weekend because it sort of squeezes my day, especially the days when I have to see my clients, which I do once a week. But I'm doing pretty well. And sometimes, you know, if I can't finish a blog post on the day, then it will go out tomorrow. And it's also not the end of the world. I don't think anybody's checking up on me about that at all. So...
Actually, with your blog post, it's a question I think I've asked you, because, I mean, we've known each other for quite some time. But just for your followers who are listening, it's sort of like I always tell you, I respect you so much for your honesty, and you say it as it is. How do you know when to draw that line between being honest and just being, you know, giving the review just to, you know, get the reaction from, or the following or the likes, you know, if I'm making any sense? How do you know where to draw that line?
There is no line for me, because what I did discover over time, of course, that the more critical the review was, the better the number of people following it or liking it, sharing it, and the more viral it would get. You know, I've got some key reviews that I did or stories, like one about Giorgio Nava, you know, being a liar and wanting to take me to court for that. The SA Butler Academy took me to court. the Le Chocolatier took me to court. Peter Tempelhof took me to court. And it was each time round, it was, you know, challenging my blog. And I stuck by, and it cost me, you know, up to 50,000, 60,000 rand for a high court case, because they all were, interdicts that they wanted, urgent interdicts to get me to close down the blog, but to remove that post. And, you know, it's a pretty expensive exercise to go to court and to buy, you know, to pay for a lawyer and an advocate. But I have the best possible advocate out. So it's a waste of time for anybody to try and take me to court in the future, if any of those are listening.
Are listening, please don't waste your time.
And the money, you know, so it's money that I had to pay, and it's money that they had to pay to do that. So I just want to think what you were saying, or what we were talking about.
Is there a line?
Okay. So there is no line, because I'm a Sagittarian and I'm German. So I've got a double dose of honesty. There's nothing to do to write something, because I wouldn't be honest if I had to write something for effect, or if I wanted more followers. I write, you know, if something's good, then I'll praise it. I have followers who, readers of the blog, who love that I'm critical, who will avoid restaurants that I'm critical of, and who will run to a restaurant that I praise, because they know that I'm hard to please. And they don't want to waste their own money either, you know, neither do I. So in that way that, you know, it's always honesty. And I've learned that, you know, that I must stand by it. In my reviews, I wouldn't, you know, if I don't review my own clients now that I'm in the restaurant business, and I will declare in every post, I'll disclose that this is a client of mine. So I'll announce, for example, that they've got a new tasting menu, but I'm not, you know, I'm not selling it in a marketing point of view. Mm. I'm not telling people to go. Mm. If they like what I'm saying about what the food entails or what the tasting menu entails, you know, then they are welcome to go. But I'm not pushing anybody at all.
And of course, you've turned that whole rest, you've turned that entire blog into three books, which of course made you an author. So you've now got a trilogy of books. What was that process like putting it all together? And where did the idea come from to make or turn your blog into a book series?
It wasn't actually linked to the blog at all. It was linked to me selling the guest houses and becoming, I think, a human being. For 20 years, especially when I had the guest houses. And I could start living, you know, I could start walking. I fell in love. I mean, can you believe this? First, I was on Tinder, which was my first practice shot, because I didn't have a relationship after my son was born. My son's father moved to Joburg. And that was the end of the relationship. And there was nothing for 20 years. So I was just working and working and working. And all of a sudden, with not having to work, I heard about Tinder, you know. So I went on there. And I can be lucky that I wasn't scammed, because when the request for money came, I knew, anyway, so and that led to me meeting a man that I fell in love with deeply. He was not worth that in the end, as one as all good stories come to an end. But he had such a profound effect on me that I lost 45 kilos in weight. And I, it wasn't just him, but I mean, I just stopped eating the bad stuff. And I also discovered La Parada, where you and I met each other.
Yeah.
Consentia Nick, and I'd never done exercise. You know, I was just sitting at a laptop sitting on a chair at reception of my guest house. And I didn't move. I did nothing. And this man that I fell in love with encouraged me to become spiritual. I didn't know what that word meant. From that led, you know, that one would scale down. You know, I had a 3-bedroom house with 2 garages in Fresnay.
My son
was never going to come back. You know, he lives in the UK, and he's not going to come back and live with mom in any case. So their house was far too big. And so I thought, you know, apartment is the right thing for me to do. It was totally the wrong thing to do, except that I found the most fabulous spot. It's been a nightmare where I am here with sharing my living space with Nigerians. But that's another story for another day. And this Graham guy encouraged me either to go on, firstly, to go on a retreat, a meditation retreat outside Worcester, 10 days, 10 hours a day of meditation. And thank goodness I got the most terrible bout of asthma. I couldn't handle it after within the 24 hours. And so I had to ask permission to leave. But then he said, okay, so if you can't handle that, you must go and do the Camino. And that in itself was also a fabulous challenge, because I had just learned to walk. You know, I had to practice walking. I bought a Fitbit. Oh, my God. And I am totally besotted and driven.
Yeah. You're like the Fitbit ambassador, like the unofficial Fitbit ambassador.
Yeah. So in those days, you know, you had to do 10. And so then I discovered Discovery. Obviously, I signed up with Discovery. I had to do 10,000 steps a day, you know, to be eligible for any of these awards and to build up points. And then during COVID, they dropped it down to 7,500 for my age category. So sometimes it's hard, especially in winter, you know, to be outside when it's really freezing cold. But I'm determined to get to the 7,500. Sometimes it's like real pain and lading, but even during lockdown, you know, in level 5, when we couldn't go out, you weren't supposed to be outside your house. I would go and find one item to shop at, Woolworths. I would walk with my shopping bag, and just to have an excuse, you know, to get out and to get at least 3,000 steps to Woolworths and back. And since then, you know, I can't sit still for so long anymore. I've got so used to it. I miss the dancing incredibly because that was an amazing way to keep fit. Yeah. And of course,
and like you said, you never had to really do an exercise. I remember we chatted about this before. You've lost so much weight since, like, you know, anyone who knows you from, if they see you now, it's just such a shock. But also not only that, on a personal level, on a friendliness level, on a connection level, you've also changed quite a bit, if I think back.
It's hard for me to see that, but I think people say that they were scared of me, intimidated by me, and that was mainly restaurant staff. And I think they can't think that there's another part to me. And I probably was stressed, you know, with all the work I was doing, and I was blogging at night, so I didn't sleep enough. And now, you know, I'm pretty relaxed. While I was at that stage, I was pretty relaxed. And I was just so excited about this guy and about the dancing and these beautiful boys that I was meeting there. That people would come up to me at La Parada, boys and girls, and would say to me, wow, you know, they didn't know what I looked like before. So that wasn't about the weight loss, but they would say, when I grow up, you know, I want to be like you. And I didn't know what that means. And all I could think of was like a picture of their mother or their grandmother sitting on a couch and watching TV all day. And they would never dance, you know, with their children at La Parada or go walk or exercise or do anything fun, you know. And I would come back from La Parada exhilarated. I absolutely loved being there, dancing there. I could sing along to most of the songs and they would look at me and just say, you know these words, you know, like, I mean, but I have grown up on KFM, you know, so I know every pop song. And I don't have a friend in my age group, in any other age group, that is anything like me at all, that listens to KFM, that knows the pop music, that goes dancing. And I think, even though I've written about it so much, they are missing out majorly. I still have people. I met a guy last night in the Woolworths. It was a lovely opportunity to pick up a guy. But, he was beautiful. I had this thing about a man bun, which I had a nice experience with at La Parada. And I recognized him from La Parada and from HQ, you know, and all of these places as well. So normally people talk to me and they say, hey, I remember you from La Parada. They didn't know my name, but you know, just, and here I said to him, hey, I remember you from La Parada. So he said, oh yes, that was a year ago. So, I mean, it seemed like forever for him.
Yeah.
And then he said something about his trolley. He says, look, I'm a single dad and I'm shopping for my son and my housekeeper's given me this list. And I don't know where the vegetable spices are. Do you? So I said, no, I don't cook. You know, I come to Woolies because I don't have to cook. So it was so funny. And he was a real good looking guy. So anyway, I'm gonna get better at looking where the vegetable spices are.
Yes.
You
need to know where everything is, Chris. You go to that Woolies so often. I'm actually disappointed right now. But let's chat about what inspires you to keep pushing into all of these different avenues that you go into, Chris. What is it that tells you, like, you know, I'm going to do this? What is that one thing that keeps you going into all these various parts and different careers?
Luck, I would say. I haven't looked for anything specifically. Obviously, financially, that was the closest I got to asking for a job or asking, you know, to be a consultant. And I was so lucky with Utopia because the chef there is a co-owner of Utopia. And he knew that he was going to open up a restaurant somewhere along the line. And he did so in June. He opened Zest in Seapoint at the New Kings Hotel. So I got that account as well. And the other owner of Utopia owns Anatoly. So I got that account as well. So without having to, like, you know, push for business, I haven't asked anybody for business at all, in fact. I got those three accounts. Then I got the hotel in which Zest is opened because it made sense, you know, for me to do the hotel and the restaurant inside the hotel. And then through Matt Schroeder of Homespun, I phoned him when he announced that he was opening a new restaurant at the Andros in Claremont. And I told him what I was doing now, you know, and he said, oh, my gosh, don't you want to do some social media for my dad? My dad's just opened a new restaurant called Harvest Culture at Tiger Falls. So I didn't know his dad at all. And I felt like I was a little, you know, bunny in a box, you know, that I was being delivered as a present to his father, you know, to do the social media. So Matt doesn't pay for that. He paid for it for a few months, and now I'm paid directly by the restaurant. So none of those I had to knock on a door, you know, to ask to be somebody's social media thing. And I'm loving it. I'm loving the fact that I had one or two proposals because I was asked to do them. One was for a clothing boutique for women. Another was for a small B&B in Camps Bay. And they started, and 5 seconds later, they didn't carry on with it. Yeah. And I'm so grateful because it opened up more space, you know, to do more restaurants. And that's really that I want passion. To specialize in.
Definitely. Yeah. And as a brand now, if you look at the blog, is it still like your number one passion? Or is it like, you know, you're focusing more on the PR side and the blog is just sort of on the back burner and when you can? Or is it they're both as equal parts of your life at the moment?
They are equal because I made a commitment when I started, you know, that the blog, that I would keep going and that I would do 5 days a week. Even when I traveled, you know, it was a lovely way to, when I traveled internationally, to document where I was, what I did, what I saw. Because you forget that, unfortunately, so quickly. And where I ate at. And so that it helped me tremendously with writing the book. The first one was about losing the weight. So my outings with Graham, going to visit him in McGregor, all of those had been blog posts somewhere along the line. I wrote more of the first book sort of out of my own memory of you know, our journey together. But the second and the third book had Caminos, you know, with about two different Caminos. And I tagged on the whole journey of South America into that book as well. So, and those were all day by day. I mean, they were not copy and paste, but they were edited from my Facebook posts over a 3-month period. So that was a tough challenge to edit down. You know, otherwise the book was already, it's now 700 and something pages. It would have been far more, you know, if I'd just copy and pasted it directly. So,
And I wanted to ask you another question. I know that you know, you have these three books now, and it is the trilogy. Is there a chance of another book coming, or is it something that you're going to look at doing? Or is it also been there, done that, the three books are there?
I was amazed at how much I love doing the books. I first thought, you know, because it's quite a challenge to write a blog. At the stage that I wrote the books, I wasn't doing another career, you know, so I was walking and I was cleaning up litter, so there was nothing else to do. There was no, I wasn't in a dilemma of you know, am I going to write the book or spend time writing the book or doing work for a client. So there was no client involvement at all. And so I had the time to do it. But when I write longer, like a restaurant review, those are normally 2,000 words each. I'm sometimes exhausted because, you know, I have to write every course in detail and take the photographs. And those are long blog posts. And it's what people like because they like the detail. So I thought, how am I going to survive, you know, writing a book of X number of pages? I didn't even know how many words, you know, were in a page or how it would translate into how thick it would be. And I had other dreams for books. I was going to write the definitive guest house book. Well, there's no point in writing that after I'd sold them all.
Yeah.
And still I felt that sort of guilt, you know, that I wasn't a success because I sold them. So that would have also not been that honest. So it just came to me, you know, that this was this weight, because these young people were asking me, you know, like that they wanted to be like me. And two people, obviously numerous friends looked at me. I hadn't seen me in a while and they would say, wow, what's happened? You've lost so much weight. And I obviously kept hearing that. It was very motivational for me as well. And two people on one day said to me, you must write a book and you must tell people how to do this. Because I think it's every woman's nightmare, you know. How do we keep, how do we lose weight or how do we keep our weight? So that was, there was, and having learned more about spirituality, there was a message coming to me directly. So I thought, okay, wow. And so when I started writing, I actually did a very good thing, which is I was traveling overseas and I went to stay in a bed and breakfast in Italy, in Aprecale. It's a little village that I was introduced to by Chef Jan Hendrik van der Westhuizen, who's got Jan Restaurant in Nice. And it's his favorite little escape place. It's about an hour from his restaurant. And so I booked there for 3 weeks. And I mean, it's actually very easy to write a book. I didn't know it at that stage. But you do a contents list, you know, of what you want to cover. And so I knew that I was going to do a memoir. The central core of the book would be, who am I? Where do I come from? You know, my German roots. My father, my mother, meeting my ex-husband, my son, and so that my son, so that Alex has got that information, because many of us don't know, you know, I don't know everything of my life in Germany before I came to South Africa. So that's something that I've given him as a gift through the book. And it happened to be that it was roughly 21 chapters that the book was going to be, the first book. And I had 21 days, so my goal was I had to do one chapter per day. And this is my German side. There was no day off for me. And I would do the writing in the morning after breakfast. Oh, the breakfast was so fabulous. And they had a lovely pool, and I was there in summer in August. So I could, and it gets really nice and warm in Italy in summer. And so I would write. I wasn't allowing myself to go near the pool until I finished the chapter for the day. And the owner of the guest house, she told every guest staying there, there's a lady called Chris from South Africa, and she's writing a book there. And they were all intrigued, you know. So it was actually great fun. It wasn't a burden because I, you know, I was dedicated and I didn't edit there. I was basically focused on getting the information down. And then I did the edit afterwards. And there I felt I was quite a procrastinator. It was harder to sit down and to edit and to edit, you know, and to not miss typos. So maybe next time I'll use an editor. Sure. You know, somebody can see it fresh. But I've survived that part as well of learning, you know, that discipline and to do it straight away because there was quite a time gap. And what I did do was to publish each of them or launch it to my friends on each of my birthdays at that time. So I had created a deadline for myself to say it's got to be finished by the 20th of December, which I then managed to do for each of the three books.
And after having written these books and you look back at them now, you know, you've been, like I said, you've been sort of, let's inverted commas, one of the OGs in, you know, restaurant reviewing in South Africa, one of the first, you know, people to turn it into a book, travel internationally, review internationally. Like I called you the original switch bitch, right?
I love that. Absolutely.
How have you seen the industry sort of change from when you started to where it is now? There's so many differences that, of course, you can point out. But what are the key ones that you actually, like, sit back and think, wow, and when I started out, this wasn't like this?
Are you talking about the restaurant industry?
Yeah. And of course, also just the general blogging and influencing inverted commas industry.
Okay. So I think, I mean, influencers then were bloggers. And everybody and their cats, you know, had to become a blogger. Mm. and I was that person as well. And, you know, you were like VIP. And many of us were treated like that as well, which was nice. You know, one was spoiled. But I then saw this, I called it blegging, you know, the blegging bloggers, which were these young puppies who saw an opportunity and you just wrote fabulous stuff. They were too scared to be honest. I don't think they even knew what critical means, you know. Everything was just fabulous, the fabulousness and the fabulous that. And so they didn't, and all they wanted through that was to be invited again and again, you know, to the same restaurant, you know, whenever, so that they would go onto a media list and be invited to the freebie dinners and lunches and whatever else those were offering. And people were petrified, you know, of the bloggers. They were petrified of me, I think, the most of anybody from what I've been told.
Yeah.
And everything was super duper perfect. I'm sure my photograph was in a number of kitchens. And I used to sometimes think, oh, my God, you know, I wonder if they spit into my food. But I just thought, at least it's vaguely cooked. So and there was no COVID around at that stage. So that was all okay. But and now, of course, they have evolved. They know it was too much trouble and effort because it takes a huge amount of dedication to run a blog, to keep a blog, to keep it going. I thought during COVID I would run out of something to write. And luckily that never happened. I just had to look harder for information. I could even write about COVID, you know, and how I felt about COVID. And I could write like at the end of a year or a certain milestone, say of 100 days of lockdown, of being grateful, a gratitude post, you know, of what I've learned and what I've experienced and how great lockdown has been for me, which of course nobody would say lockdown was great, but I think it was fantastic, you know. So it was still controversial, you know, how can you say lockdown was great?
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't know anybody close to me that passed away or that got terribly ill of it. So, you know, it was okay for me to say that at the time. So those blegging blogger bitches now, I like to alliterate. Now they're at Instagram. And they, because I've got, I'm the Instagram, I mean, obviously I handle the Instagram accounts for my clients and I see it at Utopia. I started an account for Chef Pavel, who's the owner, the co-owner of Utopia and the owner of Zest Restaurant. I run his account as well. So they come with this, hello, you know, like the opening shot. And I'm a social media consultant. I'm a this, I'm a that. So firstly, they want to take my job away. So they write off my party list. But can they come and, you know, can they come for a visit and then, you know, do some posts for us? Now, of course, you look at the number of followers they have. And I mean, I'm astounded at the numbers. I don't know how they get to, you know, over 100,000 of followers.
Yeah.
And, but I've been terribly disappointed with those. I mean, it's great because we've used some of them for my clients and to do a giveaway or something with them. But they don't do a post. There's a thing like a post on Instagram, which you expect to be on, you know, if you're going to do such a big giveaway with him.
Yes.
They do stories. And within 24 hours, that story's disappeared.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how stories work. So
yes.
There's no permanent record that influencer XYZ, you know, with his millions of followers, actually ever ate at your restaurant, because you can't see it after 24 hours. So now they're doing reels. The reels is the next thing. But yeah. I'm not, you can't look for a reel. I don't look for a reel. And if they pop up, they tag you in it, well, then you know that they've done it. But I don't think any other Instagram, you know, person actually can see the reels, or every reel, for example, that's been done for Utopia. So I see Instagram going that route, you know, more video orientated, less post. Less copy. I'm probably writing too much copy still in my Instagram post. But Instagram tells you when your posts are too long, so then you have to edit it down anyway. So I see very opportunistic young people with like 500 followers asking, you know, like promising to be these amazing social media la-la-las. And I'm thinking, at 500 for your own account, I mean, really? You expecting me to use you and obviously pay you? And I see big accounts like Insta Eats. I want to mention them specifically. Insta Eats Cape Town. I mean, he was pushing, and he thought he could get to my client, the chef, on his chef account. And, of course, I'm the one reading it. My client doesn't even know how to go and post a post on Instagram. And he was, like, begging and begging, you know, special reduced rates for, you know, like 5 mentions a day or a week, and then it's so much thousand, and then 2 mentions, whatever, plus 1 video. And I thought, like, you don't even know my business. You haven't even come to eat there. You know, you know nothing about my business. And you're just seeing me as a money machine, you know, for you, because you're desperate. And I've never done that with a client. I'm here. I've, as I said, got lucky with getting into these restaurants that I'm working for. And I've done a good, honest day's job, you know.
Yeah, for all of them.
Yeah, and almost, you know, say 6 to 7 posts per week, 1 per day mainly. So I really work very hard for that, but I'm not saying, here's a package, you know, and, you know, choose, buy me for this. You can have me for R5 or you can have me for R10. So I've got a fixed fee. And that's what I charge, you know. And for that, I'll do a whole lot of things for you. I reply to the reviews that they get to say thank you to the clients, and anything else, you know, any other feedback I want to give them or should give them.
It's any right to... Yeah, on a tangent from what we were just talking about now, in your opinion, what makes someone a good influencer or a good blogger then?
Well, you know, there was one word that I felt aggrieved about as an Instagrammer myself, or as a person who was going to your restaurant, eating there, taking as good a possible photographs as I could, writing a lovely post about how fabulous. I never did multiple photographs in one post. So I'd have 10 photographs of your 10 fabulous dishes and your interior. And, you know, each of them was a mention. And do you think that an Instagrammer that represents that particular restaurant would ever say thank you or share your post or share your story? Thank you was, to me, like the rarest word out, you know, from the Instagramming side. It's easier on Facebook because you want to like a post. I think people are just more naturally kind that way. And so I decided the first thing I'm going to do is I've never used the word thank you as much as I have since November when I started working on Utopia. But it's so nice because it's about gratitude, and gratitude is such a spiritual thing. We all want people to help us, you know, and to come to our restaurant, to come and eat there. But you've got to say thank you. You know, you've got to express what a privilege it is, because they can go to 1,000 other restaurants in Cape Town.
Most definitely. And sort of what has this experience been like for you producing all of this content during lockdown? I know you said you had to become more innovative. Or was it like you had to sit down and really reflect?
If you're talking about my clients, no issue, because they're making food, they're doing pretty, you know, there's pretty pictures through the dishes that they're creating. I'm now using my my Instagram followers, especially their stories. I do screenshots from the store, as I said, stories or reels. And I'm creating posts from that. And again, I'm saying thank you. Instead of saying thank you as a direct message, I'm saying thank you in a post. Thank you to XYZ for eating, you know, for dining at Utopia. And I use the screenshots from their reel. And so I've got a multiple photograph post, and they love it. It's, I feel that I've created like a vibe for Utopia, that it's a place to be seen and to be photographed at. I mean, it has fabulous views anyway. Yeah. But, you know, if you can crack getting onto a, to be a Utopia post where you are honored, you know, and thanked for having eaten there and having taken such lovely photographs. So I had, like, most people come for their five-course tasting menu, and I've got official, you know, well-photographed photographs of those five courses. But now I've got a library of photographs of which the same dishes are taken, say, with a glass of wine from this angle, from the top, from the side, with the person behind the dish. So I've got such a variety. And I think I've got much more credibility by using a real user's, a diner's photograph, you know, and their experience and their words, because they often do little captions with it, than me doing, I don't do hard sell copy at all, but it has much more credibility, you know, if I use my followers and my people, the people dining at or any of the restaurants, to actually spread the word for us in that way.
And sort of the one thing I wanted to ask you is, and I know that we're going back to your personal branding and your personal Facebook now, as an influencer and someone who shares a lot of their life, you know, who's someone when I read a Chris post, I sort of know how much you're going to share, what you're going to share. I want to know, for you, you know, people want this access to your life and they want to know all these details. Is there a line that you have drawn where you say, this is what I share and this is what I don't share with my following? Or do you just share your life access to all in these posts?
I'm amazed that people want to read, you know, my boring life, but people think I've got a hell of an exciting life. So some days, you know, I've become smarter through lockdown. Like when I have two client days, one is Seapoint and the other one is in town. So I will connect things to that. You know, then I'll go, I'll fetch some rolls on a Thursday at my bakery. I'll go get to my German bakery at Hotleaf in the garden center. So it looks like, and I give gratitude for all of those, you know, that they've kept the rolls for me, that I've had good service. And then I've been here, there, I've had a glass of wine, you know, at Utopia. I've had a bite to eat at Zest. And then I obviously sometimes go and eat somewhere else as well. And so people think, wow. And then I've, something that has like been amazing, Matthew, is that I've become better at my photographs, and I'm the sunset photograph queen for Camps Bay, which is something I never learned. But I've seen, I also thought, well, I'm going to run out of ways to photograph Camps Bay, because I'm photographing here every day, but the clouds are different every day. The sun is different. It's sometimes rainy. And I did a fabulous seagull the other day who was hovering around me because I was eating a croissant and the crumbs were falling down and wanted to come and pick it out of my mouth.
I saw that. You had such a nice action shot of that seagull flying.
Now, you know, you can do seagulls just sitting on the grass, which of course I had one or two of those. But then this one just flew, and it's a thing of, you know, snap, 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 and something might work, but it doesn't always. And the sunset. So people think that my photographs are fantastic, which is a whole new dimension of what I can do. And so the posts are much more, I think, are attractive often because people just look at see pretty pictures, you know, of the sunsets in Camps Bay, the Lion's Head, I mean, that I see, and the ocean. So, and then if I'm somewhere else, of course, that I'm sharing. I went to the Russian tea room, or the Russian tea experience at Hasendal the other day. And people loved it because, again, it was so different, you know, to eat at something like that. So, so I have one thing that I won't be honest about, and that is sometimes, you know, not everything about a client relationship is perfect. And I've had some challenges which have grown me. And so those I do not divulge.
Okay.
The one thing I've learned as well is how powerful my blog actually is, because one's tagging. So if you're looking at Google, your Instagram posts, your Facebook individual ones are not coming up on Google at all. You know, your link to Google, to Facebook, and your link to Instagram might come up somewhere. But for example, for the SA Butler Academy, two of my posts are, after 7 years of writing them, are still on the top 10 on the first page of Google. Now, that is amazing, because I'm not even visibly having a fight with him, say, this week or this month. So I have a major issue with the people that are fellow trustees of Iptide, where I live. And I learned that I wanted people to know how badly I'm being treated by them. All three of them do Airbnb, and I live here permanently, and they make my life a nightmare because they've got Nigerians here who do party music from 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, at a time when I'm trying to sleep. And I've begged, I've pleaded, I've asked, you know, for it to be controlled, for it not to happen. Nothing happened. And so now I mention the name of the owner of the apartment and the apartment number. And it's not got any power on Facebook, but it's got power because then I'm copy and pasting onto a blog post. And they, if you Google one of them, like Sasha Jack, who I mentioned the most, she's on the first, you know, my blog post on the first page of Google for her. And so I've realized the power that I have. The same with Sandak Lewin, who are our managing agents. They've also threatened to take me to court for writing about them. Very happy to get my sweet awards, but definitely not liking my star awards. So, I mean, really. But I've seen no lawyer's letter at all. So, you know, they're quick to threaten. And I'm writing the honest truth, you know, that they're inefficient, they're rude, they're whatever. And so, but my clients are holy. And, of course, I have a vested financial interest in keeping the relationship going. So what happens in the client's offices or restaurants
stay there.
So, yeah.
That's really great. Also, at the same time, you know, these last 2 years, like, you know, we've been chatting about it now. For this hour, though, it's changed you so much. Although you've been going through all of these changes, I mean, as you've been losing the weight, I mean, it's not only this last 2 years for you. How has this last 2 years, though, actually affected your life? And how has it taught you any personal or professional lessons?
Well, firstly, that you're never too old to start a new career. I mean, here's me, you know, at 67, starting, becoming a social media manager. I'm completely the wrong age profile, but I'm loving it. And again, my clients are loving me. I talk about my, like, as if the restaurant is mine, but that's how passionate I am, you know, about them. I see things critically. I give them feedback. My friends are reading about me, writing about, you know, Zest, Utopia. They're seeing the photographs and they want to come and eat, you know, so I'm helping them gain business as well. So it's a win-win relationship. And of course, I didn't know that I was reasonably well known, you know, in the food business. So we get lovely reviews on the Good, Bad and Nasty Facebook group. And there as well, the minute I spot one for a client, I will say thank you as well. Nobody there has ever said thank you for anybody posting a review. I have just grown. I've also grown, unfortunately, back in weight again. So so that's probably the biggest downside. It's all my own fault. And I'm not strenuous enough anymore. I think I must blame Discovery as well. There's a certain point when you don't get points anymore. Mm. I was so motivated every day, you know, with your heart rate and things like that.
Yeah.
They would give you points for that. And I've reached my limit for the year. And I don't understand it because it demotivates one, you know, to exercise. Yeah. But the 7,500, that's like, you know, written onto my forehead, I will not do a day, no matter how tired I am. I started something, especially in that level 5 last year, called couch aerobics. So I walk and dance at 2KFM around my couch. I've got a big L-shaped couch in my house. So that was a different way, you know, to get exercise or to do it in my garage when it rains. Yeah. So that's helped. But my life has not changed at all. Not professionally, except that I've got this job. I mean, you would expect to get a job, you know, in these times. I got my house sold in Amanas out of sheer fabulous luck. You know, it was a 5-year nightmare to get the money. Even when the house was sold, it still took a year to get the money. But, you know, it was a long journey. I learned patience through that. There was nothing I could do to speed that up. I learned great financial management, or, you know, being, I used to have to buy dresses all the time. I was besotted with, because it was such a new thing, you know, in losing weight, to be able to wear a dress. I couldn't not go into a country road or, you know, wherever I went to go and look for dresses. Well, now I've got wardrobes full that I'm not even wearing now, and I'm just wearing my walking clothes, except when I go to sleep.
It's like you, it's you and everyone else. Our wardrobes are so full. We have the same outfits on repeat every day. Being at
home. I know, but then we all, like, I don't know, guys wear hoodies and guys wear, you know, we wear what do you call them, tracksuits, you know, outfits. Yeah. And I've got walking, you know, shorts, and I've got walking leggings, and so one's not dressing up anymore. You're not dressing up to go shopping.
I miss that. Don't you miss that? You know me though. You know I like to be. You know I like to dress up, but I do miss it, and I miss seeing you around. You and I used to bump into each other all the time.
I know. So, I mean, I would wear blue nail polish because blue was just different to wearing pink or red. Now, I mean, I think, well, I'm picking up litter. You know, it's like so pretentious to wear nail polish.
Do you know what you didn't mention, and I have to bring it up, is that you are the unofficial mayor of Camps Bay. I've been waiting for you to bring this up. You are mentioning, you're mentioning the litter, you're mentioning the sunsets, you're mentioning all these things about Camps Bay. And I'm like, where's this title that we've been talking about for the last few years? Is how much you are invested in Camps Bay since you've moved there, not only with the picking up of the litter, but the businesses that are there. You walk around, you take photos, you review the businesses that are there.
But I wouldn't say that about myself, you know, somebody else might say that, but I people call me the cleaning lady of Camps Bay, so that, I think that's so funny, but I'm very proud of my title of that, so and not everybody knows it. I post on all the Facebook pages that are linked to Camps Bay. You know, when we do beach cleans, and I acknowledge young learners who help me, and also community members who help me. So we do photographs, you know, the basic stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but I think the number of people here that would like to think that they are also the mayor or mayoress of Camps Bay. So.
Well, they are wrong. It is you.
But, you know, I put my money where my mouth is by doing something. You know, those other people are moaners and groaners. And they'd say, well, and our councillor, like they do in Seapoint, you know, about Councillor Nicola Jal being terrible and la, la, la. Well, she is fantastic for us in Camps Bay. So, you know, if we don't have a councillor who picks up litter, well, then somebody must do it, you know. And I want to walk in a clean environment, and therefore I need to I need to do my bit.
Your bit, exactly. And before I let you go, because I've been having so much fun catching up with you after almost 2 years of not seeing you, what is the advice and guidance that you have for any aspiring influencer / digital marketer out there?
I think being honest, being genuine is a better word. I still see so much falseness. You know, I think Instagram is the home of selfies and, you know, pulling funny faces. That's what I call it. You know, that sort of pouting look.
Yeah, duck face. Hashtag duck face.
No, I mean, really, you know, we are all normal people. And why do you need to pull that funny face when you're on Instagram? Because it looks so beautiful anyway. You know, the way you're dressed and your makeup. And the place that you are doing this at. So I think most of us have learned to be ourselves, you know, to be genuine. And so that, I think, one has more credibility if you are just, you know, doing nice pics and showing yourself with friends and with lovely food and things like that. And I think just saying thank you, that's for me the biggest issue is that, and it's not, you know, you are not a better person because you've got 50 million followers. I don't think it makes you special at all, because your work, or, you know, your promise of giving back is 24 hours long. So like, you know, you've actually got no how can you be called an influencer? And I know that you can buy followers, and I know that can be done. I would never dream of going near that. But how does somebody get, you know, 130,000, whatever. So, and that, in fact, your work is not just of short duration, the influence of your work, say, for a client, but because of this tagging issue, it's not, in a greater scheme of things, you're not going to be found, it's not going to be found on Google. And you need a substantial, accompanying place in which you must write as well. And that, I mean, there's only blogging really is, people don't like that word blogging anymore. I think it's got a bad reputation, but call it a website, your own personal website, so that you have to go hand in hand. Otherwise, you have actually, you know, very little purpose to a client. Because you can't be found on Google.
That's absolutely amazing and so true. Thank you so much for taking hour of your day to come and chat to me. It's been so good catching up and hearing your story. I know you and I have had deeper conversations about all of these topics in our friendship over the last few years. But thank you so much. And I'm wishing you nothing but success going forward.
It's been great fun. Thank you so much for this interview.
Pleasure. Okay. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining me. Of course, remember, there are so many more episodes that you can get right here on Spotify and, of course, on Apple Podcasts. So take a look at all my previous guests, some amazing episodes and interviews right here. Thank you so much to my amazing guest, Chris, for stopping by and chatting to us. And, of course, remember, get in contact with me on social media. If you want me to interview someone, let me know. It's at Matthew Hallett on Instagram and at Matthew James SA on Twitter. Bye-bye.